Hundreds in Duval County schools are in quarantine as some students start to go back to class full time. The Kenite Drive neighborhood gets a $5 million home buyout, and the Jaguars' first home game is this weekend. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. Join us. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, the Sing Out Loud Festival goes virtual this weekend. We'll tell you how you can check it out. But first, it's Friday, and here to discuss yet another busy week in the news, we welcome Nate Monroe of the Florida Times Union. Hi, Nate.
Hey, Melissa.
Good to have you. Radio host Angela Spears with us once again. Good morning, Angela.
Good morning, Melissa.
Mike Mendenhall of the Jax Daily Record. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Melissa. Good morning.
And rounding out our foursome, journalist Claire Goforth of the Daily Dot. Claire, good morning.
Good morning.
So good to have all four of you this week. Lots to talk about, lots of news. It's all driven ultimately, though, by the pandemic. Here is the latest on the COVID crisis by the numbers. The death toll from COVID-19 in Florida now stands at 12,326 people. There have been 500 deaths from coronavirus in our area. 518, yes, including 26 new deaths overnight reported in Duval County. So against this backdrop, hundreds of Duval County students and staff are quarantined right now due to coronavirus. And there are a couple of dozen positive cases reported in the district. But district officials have decided the numbers are low enough to start easing kids back into full-time classroom instruction. Sixth graders return to in-person classes 5 days a week beginning Monday. Middle and high schoolers will follow over the next couple of weeks. Let us know, everybody, what you think about this decision by the Duval County Public Schools and what you will decide when it comes to your children. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Claire Goforth, let's begin with you. Certainly, this has been an incredibly difficult time for educators, students, parents, all over the country. And so at the same time, as we all worry about the virus, kids are losing their education. They're not getting the education that we would all hope for simply because of the reality of the situation. The majority of parents probably will send their children back into the classroom. What are your thoughts about this process that's going to be happening?
You know, I really don't envy anybody involved in this, not the school system, not the parents, not the kids. Everybody's in a bad situation. And I mean, with a few hundred students and educators who have been quarantined since the beginning of the school year out of, 100,000 in the district, that, I mean, relatively speaking, that is, it's not terrible. But for every case, there are potential ramifications, deaths. I mean, yesterday, CNN reported that since the beginning of the school year, three teachers have died from COVID-related illnesses. I mean, we're in the middle of a deadly pandemic. I think people have a lot of questions. One question I have not seen answered is how much are they testing kids for COVID and educators? I think that's one of the key ways that we can keep an eye on this. And I mean, how long will this go on before we potentially have another lockdown is what we're all kind of wondering now.
That's the worry. Nate Monroe, as the Times Union reports, Episcopal School, Bowl School, there are students in quarantine in those schools as well. And I think that's the worry all of us have, is that everyone will go back into the classroom and cases will spike to such a degree that everyone will then be sent home again.
Right. And, you know, I think that the worry is that, you know, the school system is going to essentially mirror the larger kind of society, that the testing regime is not going to pick up all of the actual cases of COVID. It will pick them up in a delayed fashion. And so the cases that are coming back positive are people who may not even be contagious anymore. And, you know, sort of adding to that is this lack of transparency into what actually is happening in the school system because of guidance from the state. It definitely seems like a kind of a precarious situation.
Yes, and certainly the leadership at the state level has come in for heavy criticism. Angela Spears, a mandate of schools being open 5 days a week, because according to the State Department of Ed, that, you know, the majority of parents want to send their children back to school. And certainly you sympathize with parents who are trying to homeschool children and work. This has just been an impossible situation for so many families. That said, I think what's so frustrating about all of this, and I speak as a parent myself, is that it didn't have to be this way. If we had had a comprehensive national strategy and response to this pandemic in the early part of this year, we would not be in the situation we are in now. We just would not. We would have been like most other developed countries that approach this in a strategic fashion, and we'd be past the worst of this. I think that's what's so frustrating for so many Americans.
Melissa, you are so, so right. That is what's so frustrating, is that we knew about it. You've heard now firsthand, for people have heard firsthand for themselves that we knew about it, and it didn't have to happen. And you know what's happening now, I think, with our schools is that we're trying to force a normality in an abnormal situation. We all want kids to go back to school. We know that, right? Melissa, as you mentioned, you're a parent. You want your child back there in the classroom. We want things back to normal, but we have to take it slowly. We want it to be done safely, right? We all want it to be done safely. We'd maybe be looking at a tiered approach at doing this. You know, Dr. Fauci has said October, November, what's going to happen then? Are we going to have to shut down the schools and we're going to be back where we were in March? And in April of this year, who knows? But, you know, it goes back to what you said. This could have been avoided. This could have been, or at least lessened, not avoided, but maybe lessened a little bit, Melissa, had we listened in the beginning, had we really hunkered down, if we're all wearing our masks like we should. You know, it's amazing when I look at New York and the state of New York, and it is just now opening restaurants. And I'm thinking here in Florida, we've been doing this. So in so many situations, we are trying to force normality in an abnormal situation.
Yeah. And, you know, Mike Mendenhall, as we talk about this, the revelations from a Washington Post journalist Bob Woodward's book that came out this week, Rage, it's titled, where he has the president of the United States on tape saying in the early part of 2020 that he knew that coronavirus was much more deadly than the flu, much more contagious, and then publicly told the American people the opposite, that it would be no worse than the flu and that it would go away on its own, when he clearly was being given good information early on as to just how deadly this is. That is really bombshell information, because, you know, if the president and his team had acted early in February, March, April, with a mask mandate, a national contact tracing and testing program, unemployment compensation for all the businesses that were going to have to be shut down, and that had been done in a more timely manner, there would have been so far fewer deaths and so much less economic pain. And we would not be in this situation now with our educational system. And this is simply the fact of the matter. And it's really incredible that this is where we are.
Yeah, and it really was a stellar reporting from the veteran Watergate journalist, and incredible access to a sitting president of the United States. I think President Trump in those interviews made the comment that his rationale for playing down the virus was to dispel any type of panic. But, U.S. presidents in past situations, past crises, if they approach the American people with a coherent plan, with, they stress the severity of the situation, but come at it with calm, it tends to put the American people at ease, is what we've seen in the past. You've seen it in throughout crises in history. So, and I think that I think it would have also given the state's governors and localities also a model to follow. We you know, the federal government could have coordinated with schools you know, early on to develop a strategy, not only a blanket strategy, but also specific to different demographics, whether it be, you know, schools in rural areas or schools in urban areas, which would have different challenges with the virus.
Yeah. Different governors, Nate, have responded to this in different ways, and it's often an ideological response. And so we've seen the consequences of that play out around the country. You know, and how about the fact, too, that Bob Woodward reported that we had known for some time that Russian hackers inserted malware into Florida election systems in the 2016 election. Now we know for sure, according to his reporting, that it was in Washington and St. Lucie counties. And what struck me about his reporting is that he said at least two counties. There could have been more. And we haven't really gotten reassuring answers from our elections officials heading into the 2020 election that it won't happen again.
We haven't gotten any answers from our elections officials. St. Lucie County is on record denying that they had any knowledge whatsoever that this had happened. And it's just a bizarre thing. I mean, for whatever reason, the federal government classified this information, and every official who has heard the details about it in our congressional delegation and in the governor's office just hides behind this classified information and says, you know, they can't discuss anything about it. And that just doesn't make sense. I mean, this is an issue of, you know, obviously like highest level of public concern.
Yeah.
It's really disappointing.
Let's go to some calls now. Oh, does somebody want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, Melissa, I just want to say, you know, and I'd mention our lawmakers and our congressional district, where are they? Why aren't they stepping up? Why aren't we hearing from them? And that's disturbing as well and disappointing.
It is. We'll continue to ask our elected officials these questions as we go to your calls. Meanwhile, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. And as we talk about sending children back to school, where do you stand? Here's a tweet from a listener. We are torn. Is there a middle ground between sending them 2 days a week to the proposed 5 days a week? That's a good question. What are your thoughts about this? 549-2937. Jane is in Ponte Vedra Beach. Hi, Jane. Good morning.
Good morning. I just read a great article about the University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana, and they had the ability with their experts on staff, they have a twice a week saliva test. And the students there are doing very well. The infection rate is less than 1%. They are having in-person classes. And after classes were opened a while, they started to see their rates tick up. The students can't get into a building unless they scan their phones to make sure that they were negative tested. And the only reason the rates went up is because people who tested positive shared phones with each other, with a negative person, and they had some parties. Mm. Now that they've been able to understand that, the rates are going back down. So it goes back to personal responsibility, even if you do get tested frequently.
Jane, thanks for that. That's interesting. Claire Goforth, I had not heard of that. I bet Florida State could have used a program like that. They've had an outbreak of COVID. And, you know, the protocols for the K through 12 system are pretty intense. There are face shields for little kids. There's temperature checks, plexiglass shields, face masks for everyone. Here is a tweet from Kevin. One problem we're facing in the classroom is logistics. There's less space for desks in each classroom when social distancing is required. I just want to say, I think the educators are doing an incredible job in this horribly challenging situation. So all respect to the teachers and administrators of our regional school systems. But, you know, Claire, what about this? Apparently some places around the country, as the caller said, are seeing some success with protocols that are really getting their arms around this virus. But, you know, it's a patchwork affair, I think, as one of you pointed out. We don't have a strategic national approach.
Yeah, that certainly is interesting that the state has no problem decreeing that all schools have to be open 5 days a week, but at the same time, they're really not creating any kind of cohesive strategy for minimizing the spread of the virus. I mean, as the previous guests have pointed out, and you yourself have noted, where are leaders now? I mean, you know, with Bob Woodward's book coming out, one question I have that's burning in my mind is, like, what did Marco Rubio know? What did Rick Scott know? What did John Rutherford know about the virus? And why are they so silent right now? I mean, if the president is willing to go on record over the phone with a journalist who's recording, there's no way that he wasn't saying exactly those same things in private meetings with Republican lawmakers. So as much as we should place blame at his feet, we should also blame all of the lawmakers who enabled him to obfuscate about the virus.
And, you know, Mike Mendenhall, as somebody here pointed out a minute ago, there's been a deafening silence out of Washington as these revelations have spilled forward. What about that?
Yeah, I mean, it just seems like, you know, our congressional and Senate leaders seem to be letting the White House drive the narrative on this. I mean, there's clearly some partisan pushback, but as far as, you know, as far as developing real strategy, I mean, there's no reason to that, you know, that there couldn't be, you know, congressional input and then push to the administration to develop a national strategy when it comes to COVID-19.
If you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable, 549-2937, and we'll go to a few more calls in a moment. But let's talk about another story from the week, the hidden costs of the convention that wasn't. JEA, we learned this week, spent $238,000 preparing for the Republican National Convention in Jacksonville, and they will probably not be reimbursed for that. That adds more money to the city's tab to host the event that, of course, didn't happen here, because of coronavirus. Nate Monroe, as you've been reporting, we were promised by our city leadership that the RNC wouldn't cost the taxpayers a dime, but it could amount to close to $500,000 when it's all said and done, correct?
Right. And actually, just a small addendum, I found an additional $30,000 in JEA-related expenses that just haven't been invoiced yet. So JEA really spent closer to like $269,000 on this non-event. Of all of the sort of quirks of this current mayoral administration, the one that I do not understand at all is this tendency to make very public statements that unravel publicly. This seems to happen repeatedly, and this notion that the city wasn't going to spend a dime on the convention just never rang true, and sure enough, is not true.
And given the city's overall budget, Nate, it's a pittance. That said, it is still real money that was splashed out for a non-event that, you know, from the start, public health experts kept warning would be incredibly dangerous. And luckily, cooler heads did prevail in the end, and we did not see a big event here in the sports complex with thousands of people not distancing, not masked, and so forth.
Sure. I will say, I mean, there are nonprofit groups that would fight tooth and nail to get $400,000 in additional city funding every year. And, you know, I just go back to what I feel like is the main point, which is that we were just told something that's not true. That to me is, I mean, it's, you know, almost more than anything else, just a simple matter of principle.
Yeah. Claire, go forth. Your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, Nate's exactly right. We just keep getting the same thing from leadership where they treat the people as though we're peeping toms that have no right to see what's going on behind the curtain. And they tell us things that are just patently false. I mean, and I don't think anybody who's serious actually thought for one second that Jacksonville wasn't going to be on the hook for some costs associated with the RNC. I mean, it's just ludicrous to suggest that. It's a huge event, and there's just so many moving pieces there. But, you know, one question I'm having now is, I mean, did the CDC leadership for a second think that maybe as the virus was raging and numbers were going up through July, did they say maybe let's not have this year? Or were they like, no, it's fine, keep coming, keep coming. And then in the end, it was the RNC and the Trump campaign that had the more responsible take. I mean, if that's the case, then I think we should really question whether or not they have our well-being in mind.
Well, you know, and of course, let's go through the history of this. Angela Spears, the RNC had been planned for years to take place in Charlotte, North Carolina. All of the preparation that goes into this type of event had been going on for several years there. Then the president pulled the convention out of Charlotte because the authorities there said you cannot have a so-called super spreader event here. You can't have big crowds without distancing. You have to follow local mask ordinances and so forth. So he pulled it out of Charlotte, and Jacksonville raised its hand and said, we would love to host the event here. And, you know, at the time they said, you can do whatever you want, basically. But then the White House and the campaign ran up against the local mask ordinance in Jacksonville. Then a group of local business owners sued to stop the RNC from coming here because they were worried about the health effects and also the prospect of protests and unrest. Let's point that out, too. And so, you know, in the end, what we saw was the convention taking place largely up at the White House and at a venue near the White House. And it's really incredible to think that after all of that, it didn't happen here, and we're out all this money.
And also, Melissa, remember when Sheriff Mike Williams came out and said, hey, it's just not safe. And when you talk with some people,
that was decisive, wasn't it? When he spoke up.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, some people are saying, too, that was just a cover to get Mayor Lenny Curry off the hook. You know, that he kept saying, hey, we can't do this. And it is amazing that, too, when you listen to the mayor, according to that Nate's reporting, too, and that the mayor said, oh, well, you know, his aides have said that no money was spent, just some time spent. Well, as a former city worker, when I worked and I got paid, that was your time, the taxpayer money. And Melissa, what I want to know, too, remember that big fundraising committee that they had with all these big wigs here in our town, in our city? Did they raise money? And if so, what happened to that money?
The RNC, Nate Monroe, the RNC host committee, it was reported in the New York Times and other places, the RNC host committee here in Jacksonville was having a hard time raising money for the convention in Jacksonville. They were the folks that were ostensibly in charge of all of the money that was going to put this event on, and they did have a hard time because of the pandemic.
Right, and we don't really have much of a view into just how much of a failure that was because they were not being transparent about how much money they had. It's tempting to want to advocate for the mayor to have his prolific donors reimburse the city and JEA for their expenses. There'd be nothing preventing them from doing that at all. And fundraising seems to be one of the few parts of his job that he approaches with any kind of enthusiasm anymore. So I'd love to see that.
If you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable as we talk about the biggest stories of the week with Nate Monroe, Angela Spears, Mike Mendenhall, Claire Goforth, and yours truly, plus your calls. It's 549-2937. Josh, our director, Josh, I'm going to jump around in the rundown a little bit since Nate just mentioned the mayor. This week, the city of Jacksonville partnered up with the Duval County Medical Society to launch a new campaign called FluVax Jax. This is a push to get more people vaccinated ahead of flu season because they are worried about flu season corresponding with the pandemic. Here's the mayor.
What a lot of people don't realize is that in flu season, without COVID-19, there are some seasons when ICUs are pretty busy, they're at capacity. And so both of these, COVID-19 and the flu season, if we don't pay attention to this and do what we can to mitigate it, can create real stress on our hospitals and our healthcare workers.
Okay, let's talk about this. FluVax Jack's Mike Mendenhall. The mayor said Wednesday that typically this area has about a 37% vaccination rate for the flu. They want to get it close to 50% so that they don't see people coming into hospital, ICUs, flooding them with flu cases when they also have to be dealing with COVID cases. This is a big push, FluVax Jack's.
It is. And, you know, typically with any vaccine, the more people you're in a geographic area that get vaccinated, the more, you know, the better the vaccine works. And let's not forget too that, you know, mild cases of COVID-19 actually have similar symptoms to the flu. So, I mean, not only would you be, infiltrating our hospital system and our ICU system, but also, you know, we have testing capacity too that we still need to keep available for everyone who's getting tested for COVID-19, and that would also, so if you mitigate those cases of the flu, you also, you know, it'll be better for all parts of our health infrastructure.
Yeah, Claire, go for it. They are making it as easy as they can for people to get their vaccines. They're trying to work with the nearly 100,000 people who are still uninsured in Duval County so that they can get vaccinated for free. People can go to fluvaxjacks.com. You can even pay for a voucher for someone else to get the vaccine.
Which is, I mean, those are all great things. And I mean, I commend the city for rolling out a very large flu vaccination program. Having experienced personal loss in that, you know, having lost my sister to the flu, I know how deadly it can be firsthand. I think that
and I'm sorry to interrupt you. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because I think it's important that people understand that as we're so worried about this COVID pandemic, that we still really do need to be seriously concerned about flu too.
Yeah, I mean, I never in a million years would have expected that at the age of 32, my sister, who was in pretty good health, I mean, would pass away from the swine flu during the H1N1 pandemic. She was not in the hospital. She just fell asleep and never woke up. Her lungs filled with fluid and she passed away.
I'm so sorry, Claire.
Who are of any age, and my sister's death and the deaths of so many right now from COVID, it really shines a very huge spotlight on the failures of our healthcare system. My sister did not have health insurance at that time. It was 2009. It was before the Affordable Care Act. And, you know, it's great that we're getting flu vaccines, but what about ongoing care for people who have pre-existing conditions, for people who get COVID and, you know, they're not sick enough for the emergency room? I mean, how many people are out there avoiding getting medical care because they can't afford it?
Angela Spears, you know, every morning when we read the death toll from the coronavirus on this program and on our newscasts, you know, every life lost is a tragedy. And if nothing else, this pandemic has thrown into bright relief the deficiencies in our healthcare system, especially our public health system. And it is admirable, as Claire said, that the city is working together with private groups on the flu vaccination initiative. That is wonderful news. But that said, we clearly have ongoing issues with access and affordability to healthcare in this country. And the pandemic has just brought that home.
You're so right, Melissa, and it just continues. And it's interesting how some people are chipping away at what's being done when you think about the Affordable Care Act. Claire mentioned her sister's story, and I'm so sorry, Claire, for your loss. And I know it still probably is painful. Obviously, it is to this day. It's never going to go away. And it just shows that we still need this, right? We need to have access to affordable care. We need access to things for pre-existing conditions. And this is an admirable thing that we're doing with the flu vaccine, trying to get that out, but we still need to do things. And we need to once again continue to talk with our lawmakers, tell them to stop putting limits on the Affordable Care Act and things that are, you know, help us with our insurance, help us with our insurance, because it's awful to navigate. As someone who's someone who's self-employed, I can tell you it's not a pretty system to have to go through, Melissa, at all.
The Affordable Care Act was so controversial for so long. And now as we head into the 2020 election, especially in a state like this, with a lot of seniors and a lot of people on the edge of the insurance system, Nate, it's no longer controversial in the sense that people, after years of opposing it, now really want to keep it. And they don't want to see these protections taken away, particularly for people with pre-existing conditions. And, you know, people with pre-existing conditions are more likely to be susceptible to this virus.
Right. I think something that gets talked about when there are these periodic efforts to repeal the Affordable Care Act is that even as the mechanics of the law and the reforms, you might call them, you know, somewhat modest, it was a pretty huge achievement in the sense that it kind of permanently shifted the ground in terms of like what we expect healthcare to be. And pre-existing conditions are, the kind of maybe the most obvious example. You know, if the Republicans want to replace the Affordable Care Act, there is this very bare minimum expectation that they include protections for pre-existing or for people with pre-existing conditions. That's a huge shift from where things were before the Affordable Care Act. And so in that way, I mean, it has been a, you know, groundbreaking, significant law. I mean, I think we're living in a world where we're not going back, you know, sort of regressing. And that's, you know, it's a big deal.
All right. Speaking of people that are in a precarious or marginalized situation, I want to touch on another story here. The residents of Ken Knight Drive along the Rebalt River in Jacksonville got flooded out terribly during Hurricane Irma and struggled for many months afterward. Now these homeowners are getting a $5 million buyout from the city of Jacksonville. The Ken Knight Drive area will join the South Shores neighborhood on the city's South Bank in taking buyouts. And they would hopefully be able to use that money, Mike Mendenhall, to move to higher, drier land. These homeowners are, in effect, environmental refugees. These are homes in flood zones. And they're simply, in too precarious a position that it's cheaper in the long run for the city to buy these people out than keep shoring up these neighborhoods. And unfortunately, we can expect more of this in the future.
Yeah, I mean, this really shows the real human face to climate change, and particularly storm surge related to climate change. The buyout program, could be beneficial for a lot of people. But it is a voluntary program, so not all the homeowners. I mean, the homeowners aren't forced to take the buyout, which could end up with a bit of a negative impact as well. I mean, the folks that do decide to stay, or if they are renters or leasers and their landlords, you know, decide to stay and they can't get any relocation funding, it decreases the property values in those areas. And, you know, and with the, if, you know, density as well, if the density of those neighborhoods diminish with other folks leaving, services will also follow that as well. So, I mean, it's a good thing that those, you know, that trying to get those folks to higher ground, get them into a less flood prone area, but there are also some negative side effects as well for the people who will end up remaining.
Yeah, Claire, as Mike said, this is voluntary, so not everyone will likely choose to take the money.
Yeah, I think I've been to Ken Knight Drive and, I mean, you know, spoken with some of the residents there. I think this is a desperately needed opportunity for people who could, once again, as we know, the hurricanes are getting stronger, the flood waters are rising higher. Meanwhile, we're dredging the river, which makes flooding more intense. They could lose everything, including their lives, the next time one of these major storm events occurs. Realistically, Ken Knight Drive is not the only community in Jacksonville that is facing these issues and will continue to face these issues. It's great that the city is doing something to help those people. There are many people standing behind them who also are going to need help. And I mean, as a society, I think we need to start to really look at these situations. And like Mike said, this is the human face of it. These are human beings who are suffering because we are not doing anything really on a large scale to try to slow the process of climate change. And the longer we sit on our hands, the more things like this we're going to see.
Angela Spears, there are a lot of other vulnerable neighborhoods around this community that are low-lying near the river or the ocean, just near water, don't have good drainage to begin with, and they're just vulnerable to this kind of storm surge and flooding. It is good that the city has started a serious conversation about resiliency in this city, so that we can think more strategically about these impacts. But the reality is, for Florida in particular, there's just more of this in our future. More managed retreat, in other words.
It definitely is, Melissa. And you know, the question, we all say, yes, it's good the city wants to do something about it, but where are these residents, these human beings, where are they going to go? What's an accept? Are we building another neighborhood for them? Are we going to make sure that this is done all over the city? What are we going to do, Melissa? These are just questions I have for the city as well. What are we going to do for the next steps? Like you're mentioning, the next neighborhood, the septic tanks are a big issue in some neighborhoods on the north side. So it's good in one part, but on the other end, what are families going to do? Where are they going to go? Especially those residents who have lived there their whole lives.
Yeah, I mean, some will take the buyout, but Nate, the city is going to be on the hook for so much more money over time. And I just don't think people realize yet, and at the statewide level either, the kinds of dollar amounts that we are talking about over the next few decades as this problem continues to worsen.
Sure. I mean, it's a billion-dollar problem plus just in Jacksonville in the long run. And as Angela alluded to, I mean, environmental justice isn't just buying people out of a neighborhood and then forgetting about it. I mean, this is complicated stuff, and it takes a lot of, it takes a lot of work, and it takes a lot of different strategies kind of working in concert with one another. I mean, it can be things like, the Emerald Trail. You know, one of the benefits of the Emerald Trail is that just simply adding green space in some of these flood-prone neighborhoods kind of naturally helps drainage. I mean, that's the sort of thinking that you have to adopt in addition to these kind of harder, flood prevention strategies like, seawalls and buyout programs. I mean, it's a big deal, and Jacksonville is unfortunately just decades behind the eight ball. It's great that we're making some progress now, but we've got a lot of ground to make up.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Chip tweets the show, aren't most of the Ken Knight properties owned by deadbeat landlords? I thought it was more than half. I hope the city only buys out owner tenants and not pads the pockets of business people who weren't helping the situation. Claire.
Yeah, that is a point that has been raised. Buying out is one thing, but those renters are going to have to find someplace else to live. This is an issue that plagues the Jacksonville community at large. There are plenty of places around town you can see rentals that are in terrible condition. I mean, a few years ago, the apartment complex, the name is escaping me right now, had some serious issues. I mean, we need to hold landlords on the hook for the conditions they let people live in.
David in East Arlington is on the line. Go ahead quickly, David.
Hi, good morning, Melissa. Just point out the obvious fact that the COVID issue, the flooding issue, the climate issue, we have one political party in this country has decided that their ideology trumps facts and science. I paid attention to the fake news in January, February, and everything that Bob Woodward said in his book was public knowledge broadcast on CNN news reports back in January, February. The virus was airborne. It was highly transmissible. It was dangerous. And a whole lot of people ignored those facts. And the big megaphone that our president had drowned out rational analysis of facts and taking appropriate action. science and facts have to drive decision-making on environmental and public health issues, not ideology and politics.
David, thank you for that. And you're right. We simply need to have access to good data for public health, for environmental mitigation, and we need to listen to scientists. And thank you for pointing that out. Okay, two more news and notes from the week. It has been an eyesore downtown for over a decade, but the Daily Record reports the long half-built and looks like it's rusting out Berkman Plaza 2 could soon be sold and maybe redeveloped. Mike Mendenhall, you've been reporting on this. Could we actually see some movement there?
There's a distinct possibility. So basically, there's a group of consultants and economic development professionals who have the building under contract. So then the current owners did confirm to me this week that that they indeed have the building under contract, and they think that a sale to this group could happen within 60 days. Now, I mean, that's preliminary. It's there are a lot of pieces that need to happen before the deal is final. But they this group's also partnered with a pretty well-known architectural firm, KBJ Architects, here in Jacksonville, and they have designs. They have plans for to demolish the building, first of all, which, you know, because that partly they say it's not going to fit into their plans, but also they say that, you know, just the psychological impact of having that eyesore gone would help downtown, you know, on a philosophical level. But they're talking three hundred units with townhome apartments and some retail.
All right. And just down the road from the Berkman, COVID protocols will be observed at TIAA Bank Field on Sunday when the Jaguars begin their 26th season as they kick off against the Colts in the first home game of the season. This is at 1:00. You can, of course, watch it on TV, although the field will be open for a limited capacity crowd with a lot of safety protocols. Claire Goforth, as a season ticket holder, I think you've been to almost every Jaguars game since they began. Are you going?
Not as many as that. I have to admit, we finally relinquished our season tickets after last year.
Oh.
So I will not be at the game. And I'm not sad about that fact. I mean, the pandemic made for an easy decision on that, but I was watching last night's game, and I gotta say, for the fans, it looks like a great experience. I mean, you basically get a whole section to yourself.
To yourself. And we're almost out of time, but let me just ask Angela quickly. There will be a message of unity as the players and the coaches will have messages like "Stop Hate," "Black Lives Matter," and a special rendition of "Lift Every Voice and Sing" will now be played at every NFL stadium on kickoff weekend. The song written, of course, by Jacksonville's own James Weldon Johnson. Angela.
I think this is really good. I think it's time that the NFL stepped up. It took Colin Kaepernick kneeling for us to get to this point in the NFL, when it comes to the NFL, for them to stand up. So I think it's great that we're able to, that the players are able to exercise their constitutional right, that they're able to do this, that they're able to express this, that we're able to see this, because this is what the players want, Melissa. They want to be able to say, hey, we're standing up against racism. We're standing up against the violence in our community, and they want to be a part of our community. It's amazing to see how sports in general, just over the last few months.
And thank you for that. A big shout out to Duval. There'll be a lot of chance of Duval this Sunday at TIAA Bank Field. We're out of time, but thank you, Angela Spears, Nate Monroe, Claire Goforth, Mike Mendenhall. Thanks, everyone, and have a great weekend. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you. A quick break, and up next, the Sing Out Loud Festival is going virtual this weekend. We'll tell you how you can watch in a moment.
Congaree and Penn, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering picnic meals in a safe, dog-friendly farm setting where social distancing is top priority. Visit congareeandpen.com for more information.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan, a mini-stroke, or TIA. happens when blood is briefly blocked from the brain. It often warns of a looming stroke and requires immediate medical attention.
Learn more at waynehogan.law.
This message is brought to you by the Florida Division of Emergency Management, Florida Public Media, and this radio station.
This is Craig Fugate, the former director of Florida Emergency Management. In this time of COVID, you need to update your hurricane preparedness plan. That means knowing what evacuation zone you live in, and if ordered to leave, you need to go. Take your pets and stay with family or friends, or at an inland hotel. Shelters are another option. Know your zone, know your home. For more information, go to floridastorms.org. That's floridastorms.org.
I'm Tim Mack, NPR's Washington investigative correspondent. Public radio serves as a link between you and elected officials, keeping our government responsible for its promises and for its actions. Getting the story right requires many steps, but once you decide to support this kind of rigorous journalism, making the leap from listener to new member is easy. Here's how to donate to this station.
Please call 353-9528 or visit wjct.org.
Keep calm.
I wanted to always play it down.
And carry on.
He really didn't say anything different between what he told us and what we told him and what he ultimately came out publicly and said.
California's sky turns orange as Oregon's governor calls the latest wildfires historic. We'll tackle all of it on the Friday News Roundup next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, St. Augustine's popular Sing Out Loud Fest is going virtual this weekend. Starting tomorrow, Sing Out Loud virtual sessions will feature live stream performances by area musicians in the beautiful natural surroundings of St. Johns County. This is taking place every weekend for the rest of the month, and you can stream it via the festival's website or Facebook page. Diane Yamarkovitz is public relations manager for the Sing Out Loud Festival, the St. Augustine Amphitheater, and the Ponte Vedra Concert Hall, and she's on the line. Hi, Diana. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning, Melissa.
So it's great to hear that this is still going on in St. John's throughout the month. But of course, because of the pandemic, you will be streaming these incredible musical performances. Tell us how this is going to happen.
Absolutely. So as you said, throughout the rest of this month, we have chosen seven different locations around St. Johns County to do live streams with some of the musicians from St. Johns County. And this would have been the fifth year for Sing Out Loud Festival. And it has just grown into this amazing celebration of live entertainment. And our hearts were broken, as so many's hearts have been broken over music festivals not being able to take place. But we wanted to carry on the spirit this year and do it again, but do it, you know, with certain measures in place. So we chose seven outdoor spaces and a number of artists to live stream there so that people can still experience live music, because we're all missing the live music. And we need that opportunity to support our artists and celebrate music, but in our own special way this year. Mm-hmm. So that's where the genesis of the festival came from.
Yeah.
But we also...
Go ahead.
Sorry. Oh, yes. So seven different locations, different artists every weekend, Saturdays and Sundays at different times. And all the information is online at singoutloudfestival.com.
So the musicians will be at places like Alpine Groves Park, Favor Dykes, Fort Mose, Beloothahatchee, the grounds of the amphitheater, and the Ponte Vedra Concert Hall. Are you discouraging fans from coming out and watching at a distance? Should everyone just experience it through the stream?
Yes, because of social distancing, we highly encourage people to just stream them online. We do also encourage people to visit these outdoor spaces. You have this gorgeous setting at Alpine Groves, as well as Favor Dykes and Fort Mose and Beloothahatchee. Of course, Beloothahatchee is home to the famed Stetson Kennedy home. So you can visit these places online virtually and listen to the music. And then when social distancing can happen, certainly go out, and we encourage people to go visit these spaces because they are true treasures of St. Johns County.
Right. Now, this is the fifth annual Sing Out Loud Festival. Hopefully next September, it will all be back in person. But it's really a growing musical tradition for St. Johns County that you've built so nicely. And so that's got to feel pretty good.
It really does. Last year was one of the was a pinnacle for us. It, I mean, just the level of artists, the excitement behind it, the everybody, they now know they can count on this every September, and they get excited for it. So it was, again, pretty heartbreaking to say, hey, we're not going to do it this year for, obvious reasons, but how do we still carry on that tradition so that when we come back, hopefully, in full force next year, you know, there wasn't really that much time missed, or there wasn't, the experience was still there, it just might not have been in its full capacity. But when we come back, it will hopefully, again, be picking up where we left off and have this great celebration of live entertainment and bringing our community together, because that's the other thing is so many people come out and they see people they haven't seen in a while. They get to support their friends. They get introduced to new music. And it's a full month of this really exciting feeling of being in the mix with your community and supporting live entertainment.
You can check it all out at singoutloudfestival.com this weekend or on their Facebook page. These incredible live streamed performances kick off this weekend and run through the month of September. Thank you so much, Diana Markovitz, PR manager for the festival. We're going to close with a little music now from one of the performers. It's Aslan and the Naysayer. They will be performing Saturday, September 19th at Alpine Groves Park. This is Holding Out for the King. Enjoy, everyone, and we'll be back Monday morning.
But to the King, my heart is true. Well, the posters on my wall will work just fine. And I wake up looking at him in the morning time. Well, I can't tell you exactly just what it is. I'm holding out for the King. I'm waiting on Elvis. Can't find one that compares. But I try to keep an open mind when I see another guy's, knowing that the King is in my prayers. Well, the posters on my wall will work just fine. And I wake up looking at him in the morning time. Well, I can't tell you exactly just what it is. I'm holding the King, I'm waiting on Elvis. Well, the posters on my wall will work just fine. And I wake up looking at him in the morning time. Well, I can't tell you exactly just what it is. I'm holding out for the King, I'm waiting on Elvis. Well, I can't tell you exactly just what it is. I'm holding out for the King, I'm waiting on Elvis.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.